We have thousands of stories talking about it.
Sure.
And we have documentaries. We have news stories. And that is Natalie here? Somebody here to turn that? I could show you a couple of things. And I would, I have to, it has to be responded to.
Yeah, sure. We have,
let me see the articles, please, if you would. And turn the lights down. Turn the lights down and just put this on. It's right behind you.
Well, now that was a moment. President Cyril Ramaphosa, the president of South Africa, was visiting the Oval Office with his delegation. And after the opening statements, President Trump, you heard that. Turn the lights down. I want to show you something. Now, that didn't come out of nowhere, but it sort of did. It was a shocking moment. And the reason it was a shocking moment, because this is how the thing started. Now, this clip starts with a reporter asking a question, and then you hear Ramaphosa jumping in to answer the question. And I'm doing this in reverse because I think it's kind of cool. This is what caused President Trump to turn the lights down and show videos and show him news articles. Let's listen to clip 18.
What would it take from you for you to be convinced that there's no white genocide in South Africa?
Well, I can answer that for the president. It's for him. No, seriously.
I'd rather have him answer.
Yeah, I'd rather answer that. It will be,
our president will respond to you.
Yeah,
thank you, Mr. President.
It will take President Trump listening to the voices of South Africans, some of whom are his good friends, like those who are here. When we have talks between us on the quiet, around a quiet table, it will take President Trump to listen to them. I'm not going to be repeating what I've been saying. I would say if there was Afrikaner farmer genocide, I can bet you these three gentlemen would not be here, including my Minister of Agriculture. He would not be with me. So it will take him, President Trump, listening to their stories, to their perspective. That is the answer to your question.
Oh boy, did he set himself up. And the question was, President Trump, what will it take you to believe that there is no white farmer genocide in South Africa? So the president jumps in to say, well, if there were that, my Secretary of Education here in the office, who's white, wouldn't be here. Why, there's just, you know, that's ridiculous. And that's when President Trump lowered the lights and showed videos and audio of the encouragement by Julius Malema to kill white farmers, and got very graphic about it among crowds of thousands. So that's what happened in the Oval Office. It was a drop-dead moment. And I want to tell you, interestingly enough, when I was preparing for this show and pulling a lot of clips and learning a lot as I was pulling them, I pulled 20, I think. The main clip, which was the one of that interaction in the Oval Office, I couldn't find it in the search. I couldn't find it. And Google would block it. I found the link, and then it would go off, and the screen would go blank. So I don't know how widely this is being reported. I know that news sources are denying. There's no way. There's no way that's true. That's if they said right away that that was a Trump's lies, or it was, you know, well, basically, that's what they said. They must have used a different word, but they talked about how that can't be true. It's not true. He's wrong. It's not true. So that's how it happened, and that's how it was, that President Trump played all of these clips and showed him all of these magazine articles. And so today we're going to talk to a man who grew up in Africa. He grew up in Rhodesia, which ended up being Zimbabwe, because they went through something similar in their own country. And still are. The white farmers were killed. The people began to starve. 10,000% inflation. It really was a nightmare for that country, and still is. And so now the poison has made its way to South Africa. So we're going to talk about that today because, first of all, I don't know if you realize, but the Chinese have actually infiltrated South Africa as well, building this Belt and Road Initiative and trying to, you know, increase their influence around the world, and it's become a huge problem. So Africa matters. It's a huge continent, and to many of you, well, you go, duh, of course Africa matters. It's not, though, an industrialized nation for the most part, And so most of the time, it doesn't make news a lot. So most of the time, we don't think about it as being as important to the world's stage as it actually is. The G20 will be taking place in South Africa in a couple of weeks. So the Americans have been giving them aid, and we've cut aid off when news of this kind of killing of the white farmers had been taking place. So Ramaphosa came to the Oval Office hoping to get a lot of money and a lot of aid, and this is what happened. So we'll discuss this today, the importance of it. But first, abortion has remained the world's leading cause of death for the fifth consecutive year in 2023, despite the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Tragically, this total is greater than the number of deaths attributed to the next seven causes of death combined. Sadly, with the abortion pill accounting for over 60% of all abortions, babies' lives are at an even greater risk now. And that's why we work with Preborn to try to stop this in, I think, the most beautiful way possible, and that is by showing women the image of their baby in their womb and letting them decide for themselves that that life is more precious than their freedom or whatever it is that they think they're choosing over the life of the baby. They do it so beautifully, and that's why we ask you to go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. And make your most generous donation. And one last thing, Preborn, by the way, has a 5-star charity rating. So you can give to them with confidence. Go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy. Well, you can call us at 662-821-2040. You can write us at sandy@afr.net. You can listen to us on any podcast platform. Our home base is afr.net. That's American Family Radio.net, but all other podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple, whatever you like, Amazon, whatever you listen through, we are there. You can find us on social media, all the platforms. You can follow me on X and my Twitter handle. Isn't that lovely? I remember when they used to start saying that, I thought it was so funny. I could hardly bring myself to saying it. And now I'm saying it. It's at Sandy Rios Tweet. That's at Sandy Rios Tweet. All right, so today is going to be very interesting. I promise that you will not be bored with this discussion with Lynn Everswick, an Afrikaner himself. He's from Norwegian heritage, though, but his family were pioneer missionaries in Rhodesia, and he grew up in Zimbabwe and then went back as a missionary in Zimbabwe, which is a neighboring country to South Africa. So stay tuned for this interesting and important story on Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness, that we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice. Not social justice, but God's justice, what's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
Must never be scared to kill. A revolution demand that at some point there must be killing, because the killing is part of a revolutionary act.
Shoot to kill, Yamaza. Kill the poor, the farmer. Kill the poor, the farmer. Brr, pa, pa, brr, pa, pa.
All right, what you can't hear, this is Sandy Rios with you. What you can't hear is the huge crowd shouting with him. And that was just part of the video that President Trump showed President Ramaphosa in the Oval Office. I don't know if you saw that moment. Many of you probably did, or you've seen parts of it. But today we're going to have a discussion about what that was all about, but even more deeply, more about the country of South Africa and Africa itself. And when I started planning this and thinking about it, I've been working on it for several days here, actually. I couldn't think of anyone better to join me than my own friend. His friendship with me doesn't qualify him for this, but it's his life experience, because Lynn Everswood grew up in Africa. His parents were pioneer missionaries in Zimbabwe, which is really a very, in many ways, a lot like what South Africa is experiencing. A lot of rich countries developed by white immigrants like 500-600 years ago. In Zimbabwe's case, it was the Brits, and in maybe other nationalities, but that's the main influence. And then in South Africa, it was the Dutch. That's generally speaking. There are other categories. I think Germans too. But it's the same kind of conflict where farms were grown and the white farmers, the white people, the white immigrants of 500 years ago actually ran these farms. And so that's the basis upon which we're going to talk about this. As I said, Lynn knows this story, parts of it. He's lived it. He was, when I met him, a regional director for Team Missions, and Team was one of the premier mission agencies in the country, and of course their territory was Africa, South Africa, and Zimbabwe, and then got married to what became my dearest friend, his wife Judy, and they were in serving as missionaries in Zimbabwe for 15 years, lived through the revolution there. And so I just wanted to give you the backdrop of why I've asked Lynn to join me. Lynn, thank you. Thank you for joining your friend who's known as Sandy Rios in the morning. Thank you for joining
me. Thank you, Sandy. It's a joy to be with you again.
Yeah, it's the same, yeah. Same with you, Lynn. All right, so when you were at Team, remind me, what were the countries that you oversaw?
I actually initially had responsibility for Southwest Asia, parts of the Middle East, and then later on, Africa, which included Zimbabwe, South Africa, and further north as well. But it was a time to get back to where I had served originally, and so it was a great joy to be there.
Yeah. So your parents literally, this could be a whole story on its own, but they literally went to Zimbabwe as missionaries when there was nothing. I don't think there were any missionaries there then. Were there?
Actually, there were two couples there before my parents arrived, but that was basically it. And everything was from scratch. They had to build their own home and make their own way. And the nearest city was over 100 miles away. And so they really had to, they truly were pioneers in every sense of the word. And as a young boy growing up, I just watched them very closely, and I sensed that they had a real sense of God's calling on their life. And as a result, all four of our siblings went back and served as missionaries in Zimbabwe.
Yeah. I just would like to add, I had the privilege of meeting both your parents, and your mother's still living. She's almost 100, isn't she?
She's actually going to be 104 on August 17th.
Oh, okay. I lost a year or two. Oh, my goodness. And yeah. still amazingly vibrant. Okay. Well, when you were growing up in Zimbabwe, Lynn, was there a sort of apartheid? I mean, how would you describe racial relations in Zimbabwe in your youth?
In my early youth, of course, it was part of the British Commonwealth of Nations. You know, the British were running things. And then later on, after UDI, when Ian Smith took over the Rhodesian Front and they ran the country, I think it was for 12 years, I lived all through that. And then into the end of that, when it became the Liberation War, the War of Independence. So I experienced a lot as a young boy growing up. I fell in love with the Shona people. Many of them were my close friends, but I went to a predominantly European school. There was a sense of segregation in that the whites tended to stick together. And it's interesting, when my parents went out and some of the early missionaries, they started providing schools for some of the poorer rural areas. And as a result of that, the education system began to take off in the country. But previous to that, it wasn't really an important feature. It was a big change from the British to the Ian Smith regime over 12 years. And they developed the country. They provided extra roads and buildings and factories, and they were pretty self-independent. And then independence came, and the country was, in a way, now under the control of the black majority, which in the end is a good thing, I suppose. But I think my big concern and the thing I noticed the most was that the white population had brought a lot to the country, had provided infrastructure and roads and railway and factories and fuel and all the things that help in the country. Many of the remote African population still lived in villages, and they didn't benefit a lot from that, but they did some. But then after independence, it was sad in a way to see that some of that was degrading a little bit. It wasn't blossoming as it was earlier. And I think part of the reason is that it's not that that you oppose the change or that the change is a bad thing, but it's how you change. And we had many, many friends who had been there for many, many years, for generations. And then after four or five farmers in their area were killed, their land was taken over by the government or local officials. And then they had to leave the country, many of them, with just a suitcase. And it was just a really tough time. And so I've always felt bad. My heart has always been for the Shona people there. I've loved them. I've got, as I said, I've got a lot of good friends there. And I just wish the best for them. But I think somehow some of the politicians have caused the nation to they haven't done it in a good way, a way that would have benefited all people living in the country, but it just made it very difficult.
Yeah, let me say a few things, because, Lynn, you know how it is with history and culture and certainly geography. People don't seem to know those things anymore. And so we need to say that when you lived in Zimbabwe, it was Rhodesia. I should have said that. And Rhodesia right. was under British rule, and that's what you were saying. And then you and Judy lived there. When you went, married Judy and went back, you were there during the revolution, which is kind of like the corollary to the apartheid in South Africa, which we'll get to in just a second. And as I recall, right. not only were you're the kindest, but it was brutal. You saw so many friends killed. You said that was dangerous for you. And as I recall, inflation went to 10,000% at one point because the economy, the wheels were just off the bus, and they still are off the bus, aren't they, Lynn? I mean, Zimbabwe's not thriving, is it, economically, or is it? Maybe I'm wrong.
No, economically, it's been struggling, and they keep trying to come up with a new type of finance and that to run the country, but it keeps coming back to the U.S. dollar. And there's a black market that's very significant, and it's a difficult time. The economy is not doing well at all, and they need to somehow get a handle on that. But unfortunately, a lot of times there's a lot of corruption that goes on, and funding that should be going to the people ends up in politicians' pockets and things like that. So it's the same problem in many countries.
Yeah, well, I think that's because human nature is the same. So that doesn't know a color, I don't think, does it? Corruption like that. I think it's across the board tempting to people in power. But, okay, so South Africa is at the very tip of Africa. And Zimbabwe, what once was Rhodesia, is just above it. And it's a neighboring country. So when you were growing up, were you aware? I mean, did you know much about what's going on in South Africa, or was that a remote country because you were in Zimbabwe or Rhodesia?
Well, we would go down there often for our vacations to Durban and Cape Town and other places. It was a beautiful country, and we were aware that it was run by the white population predominantly. But we were experiencing that in Zimbabwe as well, so it wasn't like something that was glaring as we went down. It was just something you got used to. But then as time went along and some of the resistance began to build, and some of that resistance was trained in North Korea and Cuba and other places like that, then they started coming back in. And little by little, you began to feel the noose tightening on the farmers, especially, And it just became very uncomfortable. And it was during that time I was ministering both to the African church population as well as to a small group of European miners and farmers that were in the town we were in. And they desperately needed each other. They held on to each other every week almost. For a while there, I was doing funerals, and it was just a very difficult time because I think they realized that things were changing, and what they had enjoyed up to that point was possibly slipping away. And many of them then emigrated to South Africa, to Zambia, to Australia, New Zealand, and around the world. And so we lost a lot of friends. Many of them died on their farms. Many of them died in serving in the military. And I grew to love those people just as much because God loves them as well. But I also understood that many of the African were losing family and loved ones as well. And so it was a really tough place to be. And I've always said the only thing that can bring the two together to understand one another and reach out to one another is the cross.
Yes, absolutely. No question about that. And I actually want to talk in a minute, in a few minutes here, after, of course, what's happening there spiritually, what the missionaries have accomplished in Zimbabwe and also in South Africa that you can say. But before we do that, so how would you compare? So you feel that the, and rightfully so, that the revolution in Rhodesia, which became Zimbabwe, was Marxist influenced. Do you feel that what happened in South Africa, the that ended up in stopping apartheid, which everybody is, I don't know what's true and what isn't. Let's just say it's celebrated. But we know that there have been a lot of people that have been killed that have been white as a result of that. Was that a Marxist influence also from your perspective, Lynn? What happened in South Africa?
I think there was some, but you know, Mandela really set the table for the country in many ways, and he was a lot more open to let's make sure everybody's included. And originally, I think the ANC was a lot more democratic that way and more inclusive. What has happened, unfortunately, is the ANC has gradually been losing support. And in fact, in 2024, they came close to really coming unglued a little bit because of the way they're leading the country, because of the economic downturn, the corruption and all that. But there are other parties that are part of the process. The MK party that Jacob Zuma, former president, was. He was a Zulu. You know, then there's the EFF, the Economic Freedom Fighters, and that's the party that this young firebrand, Malema, that you saw on the tape that President Trump displayed in the Oval Office, he's a real firebrand, and he creates a feeling of if you kill a white, it's okay, but if you kill a black, it's not okay. And he's very, very, it's playing off the original sense of the Afrikaner, the Boers, the South African apartheid system. They kept us down. Now it's our turn to take back from them everything they took from us. The problem is how you do that. Mandela did it in a beautiful way. He included everybody. I don't know if you remember the rugby team, the Springboks, and how they played while he was still around, and the joy that all of South Africa felt, black and white. And I really felt good that South Africa was maybe headed down a different road than Rhodesia was when becoming Zimbabwe, and that they would do things differently, that they would make sure nothing would come between that coming together, doing it the right way, as I say. But then here comes this firebrand, Malema. He's a young guy, and he's got all the militant young people with him, and he starts doing these chants and jumping up and down and using these songs in the stadiums and getting people all worked up. And a lot of it is saying, hey, they're the enemy, in a way, is basically what he's saying, even though he denies that.
Yeah,
he's shining a light on the white farmers, and he's saying they shouldn't be there. We should take that. Yep. And that's the impression that comes, whether you're actually saying it that way or not.
Yes.
And white farmers live in fear.
Yes, Lynn, let's stop just for a second because I want people to hear. I did play. That was Julius that I played just as you were joining us. But I want to play another one because this illustrates what you're talking about. This is Julius Malema, and he is part of the EFF party. But I want to also hasten to add, it doesn't look small to me. He has thousands in these meetings, and it's not just one. There are several clips, but let's listen. This is clip 7.
To kill your master, kill the poor, the farmer, kill the poor, the farmer.
The mayor of DA in PE is a white man. So these people, when you want to hit them hard, go after a white man. They feel a terrible pain because you have touched a white man. Not because Mashaba and Soli will not be touched. They will be touched, don't worry. But we are starting with this whiteness. We are cutting the throat of whiteness.
Shoot to kill Yamasa. Kill the Boer, the farmer. Kill the Boer, the farmer. Brr, pa, pa, brr, pa. Shoot to kill, Yamasa. Kill the poor, the farmer. Kill the poor, the farmer. Brr, pa, pa, brr, pa, pa.
All right, so that's several rallies, at least three right there. That's Julius Malema. Again, he is the voice to kill the white people in South Africa. And the Boer, explain what that is, Lynn. We need to explain that.
Okay, well, the Boer are that's really another term for white farmer. And it comes out of the whole Afrikaner background, the Dutch background. And these white farmers have land, and because of the apartheid, about 8% of the farmers owned a majority of the arable land in that, and so it is a problem. But again, I go back to how you do it is the most important thing, and I'm so glad that President Trump shone a light on this issue. It might help save South Africa because if you notice that. Ramaphosa, when he saw that video in the White House, he didn't take that opportunity to jump up and say, no, that hate speech, I condemn that. He didn't. He kind of chuckled and giggled about it. But, you know, it's terrible when official government parties within the government are speaking like that and saying things like that and inciting that kind of violence. I don't care if it's black or white. It's wrong. And the government needs to stand up to it because if they don't, they're going to lose their country. If these guys, if Malema and his people take over, there will be bloodshed like we've never seen before in that land. And we don't need that. We need unity. We don't need disunity, which Malema would create.
Yes. And I want to also make it clear that Julius Malema is a member of the parliament in South Africa. I have a clip him standing up in parliament and saying, in fact, we should play that. This is Julius Malema, member of parliament, speaking up. Let's listen. This is clip 5.
There's nothing you can do. There's nothing this parliament can do with or without you. People are going to occupy land. We require no permission from you, from the president, from no one. We don't care. You can do whatever you want to do. Who are you to tell us whether we can occupy land or not? We are going to occupy land. Yes. South Africa, occupy land. That's
Thank
who
you.
We are.
Honorable
do whatever
member,
you want
Deputy
to do.
Speaker,
you can
Deputy
withdraw
Speaker,
my membership
Deputy
from
Speaker.
This
Speaker.
Useless parliament.
Honorable. Yes, honorable member.
Yes, honorable member.
It's sad. It's unconscionable. And I guess for me, that's why I would love to have seen President Ramaphosa address that issue. And I think his ANC party would be strengthened as a result, rather than seeing this support declining. Because I think people, when they hear this type of thing, that farmers are being threatened, land is being reclaimed in ways that are not right. You know, new businesses don't want to come. New industry doesn't want to come because there's uncertainty. And the government needs to get a handle on this man, Mandela, and not Mandela, I'm sorry.
Malema,
yeah.
Julius Malema.
And, yeah.
Hey, let me get, Lynn, I am confused. I shouldn't be, but I am. You guys went through the revolution. What do you call it? That strife. What label do you put on that? Revolution in Zimbabwe.
The hard thing about this, Sandy, is, you know, because Judy and I ministered to both black and white in Zimbabwe as missionaries and pastor. And when you were with the African, the black African brothers and sisters, you know, it was a fight for independence. It was freedom fighters. When you met with the white farmers and miners who were losing their farms and homes and jobs and everything and were dying in the war as well, they called them terrorists. So you had this tension going on between the two races that was really, really difficult. And that's why I say it's really important that somehow, how you manage that transition is more important than the transition itself, almost.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid that South Africa now, if they let Malema keep going the way he's going, that South Africa is headed into a similar state as Zimbabwe faced.
Yes.
With a declining economy, with a lot of hurt. Yeah. You know, something I learned, Sandy, that I found really interesting was that today, in 1988, there were 120,000 white farmers, and today there are 32,000. So that's a tremendous drop of white farmers that have left the country, and that economically is a drain on the country as well.
Is that Zimbabwe? Zimbabwe or South Africa?
That's South Africa.
Okay, all right.
That's South Africa. I'm sorry. I'm getting sidetracked here, but. And then in 2024, 70 people were murdered every day. That's a general genocide that you can't find many countries that come even close to that.
No.
It's a real serious situation. And my prayer is that South Africa somebody will stand up and say, no more of this. Let's get back to Mandela's perspective on this country where we can work together and encourage one another. And if we do take over land, do it the right way. Don't just take it. Don't send goon squads to chase people off the land. Make sure you do it the right way. Make sure you give or offer a measure of compensation that's fair. And then it'll work fine. But this way, it's not going well.
Lynn, I just was curious about a timeline. That's what when you guys were became Zimbabwe, you were there 15
right.
years. Was that early 80s when that transition took place?
It was actually 70s.
Okay.
70s through 1980 was independence, and then we left in 1983 to serve at in Wheaton.
Okay.
At the team office.
All right. So now go to South Africa. When did apartheid finally, you know, the question is when? When did Nelson Mandela come to power with the African National Congress, which is called the ANC, and that's what you are referring to, and Nelson Mandela led the country for a while. When did that happen?
I believe that was 1994. When apartheid ended and Mandela became president.
Yeah. Well,
You'll have to check me on that, but I think that's when it was.
You know, I actually think you're right. I think I did see that now that you said that. I want to play something because you made the statement that Mandela put something really beautiful in place. And so we've captured something that he said when he was still living and when he had just taken over. And I believe it was, as you said, 1994. This is clip 24.
We enter into a covenant that we shall build a society in which all South Africans, both black and white, will be able to walk tall without any fear in their hearts assured of their inalienable right to human dignity, a rainbow nation at peace with itself and the world.
So, Lynn, you've already said this. So you're from your perspective, that actually worked for a while in South Africa.
Yes, I believe so. And it really did. And then until you political groups started trying to go back to that war mentality, that take back the land mentality, rather than how do we do that in a way that will allow South Africa to prosper, that will allow the white farmers to be proud to be white farmers and serve the country to the best of their ability, to amalgamate and join together as races in activities and in everything about South Africa. It's a beautiful country. It's got such potential, more than many countries. And it's just sad to see it unraveling. It's like somebody's taken a scissors to a ball of cotton yarn and is starting to cut it, and it's just shredding. And they need to get a handle on it pretty quick, or things are going to be very, very difficult for it.
Yeah, it was shocking for the world to see that. Now, Joel Pollack is this is interesting, Lynn, because he's another person that it doesn't matter. It's just, I knew when he was a young man before he even got married, and now he's made a good mark in media right now. And he married an Israeli girl as part of the Israeli military, but he ran for Congress in Chicago years ago when we were there against Jan Schakowsky, and I was cheerleading him. He was probably 22, but he is a South African. And so he was on Fox a couple of days ago. And this is, I just thought it'd be interesting to hear what he had to say. This is clip four, Joel Pollack.
That is the South Africa with which the United States has a good relationship, not the South Africa of corruption, crime, and racial incendiary rhetoric that pushes an agenda of radical redistribution. The woke ideas of racial redistribution are destroying the South African economy, just like they threatened to destroy our institutions over here. And you heard the pleas from those in the Oval Office, from Ernie Els, from others in the room, please, we need American help to get the reforms through that are necessary for South Africa, not just to have good relations with the United States, but to save itself from economic collapse. And even though this was criticism from Trump against South Africa, it was the best thing to happen to South Africa since the end of apartheid.
All right. So you said something similar earlier, and I just wonder, so again, would you agree with Joel? It's the best thing that could have happened?
Absolutely. And I love the way he referenced Ernie Els and that, but Retief Goosen was the golfer that actually indicated that he has family members that have felt this fear living on a farm. And I'm just glad that a light was shown on it. Sure, they're the minority. Sure, there are many more black South Africans that are killed and as a result of crime and all that's going on in the poor economy, and people become desperate. But there is a group that are able to help the country and produce, and they're living in fear. They're putting up fences around their security fences. They're hiring all kinds of security firms to come and take care of them. And it shouldn't be that way. There should be an openness and a support from the government rather than this kill the Boer. That just doesn't help. It's not helpful.
You know, this is something that I suspect, but you're the expert. So you and Judy worked with the Shona people for a number of years. You both speak Shona. So that's a tribe in what was Rhodesia. How about South Africa? You mentioned it before. There's one tribe. What are the tribes there? Are there similarities there with Zimbabwe?
Not really. Of course, everybody knows about the Zulu tribe and Jacob Zuma, who was the former president in South Africa. He was from the Zulu tribe. But you have the Nkosa and you have a bunch of other tribes. I don't know them all. But there's definite competition there. And even that sometimes can be tense and become bitter. But there's got to be a way to come together, and especially in a, they call themselves a democratic nation. These government, they all have a say, they get elections, they vote on, and they have representation in the parliament. But there is that tribal tension as well, which is normal. But I think that they need to find a way to work together to accept the leader, and the leader needs to be firm and say, we're not going to have people speaking out in such a way that brings fear and bitterness and hatred and despair and causes the loss of agricultural input and everything else by chasing these people away. It's just, it doesn't make any sense. Buy them out if you want to. Encourage them to sell, but give something fair for the farm and then take it over. But the way they're doing it, it's not helpful for the country at all.
But Len, this is someone to challenge you, because you now, you of all people know that you're speaking as a Christian and also a person from the Western world in terms of your mindset. And I guess my point is, we're dealing with people who are historically tribal. They're not historically Christian. Like violence and terror is part of their DNA, I'm thinking. So I'm just wondering if that isn't a huge factor here. Like when we hear those videos and we hear this Julius Malema talking about killing, and I've seen so many stories about just the horrendous brutality. But isn't that part of the DNA of tribal people?
I don't think, I wouldn't agree with that, Sandy. I think that there's some beautiful traditions, and the tribal people have their own culture and everything else. At some points, it does rub up against other tribal cultures in that. And there's nothing wrong with having a tribal culture. You know, Europe still has, you know, Albanians and Serbians, and they're all tribal as well. You've got to find ways to work together. But I think it comes down to just bitterness and hatred. And for some people, they see this as a way of, because they lived under apartheid for so long, this is a way of getting even. And it gets people saying, yeah, that's right, that's right. And then we get back to that whole thing of fighting the war all over again. We've been, how long has it been now? It's been 30 years since apartheid ended. Let's get a new South Africa. Let's live into what Mandela said. And let's look to the good of the country as a whole. I don't care if they're a minority. I don't care if it's a family of five that are struggling and people are mistreating. Whoever is, it shouldn't be happening. And especially from government officials that sit in parliament. And this guy Malema needs to be pulled up on that by the leadership of the ANC and of the parliament as a whole.
But I believe everything you're saying, Len, but would you not agree that without God, the God of the universe, the one we serve, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, people of all colors become brutal and they kill, because it's a lot of spirits and demons. Now, you would know. I'd say when it comes to American Indians, you know, when I've watched a lot of the, because I love history, one thing that I learned from a Lewis and Clark exposition, which was, by the way, I recommend that to any of you to learn about that. They, you know, encountered on their way out to the Pacific Ocean tons of tribes, different tribes in America at that time. And the one thing that stood out to me was that some of those tribes were known for being particularly brutal, cruel, and not all the tribes were that way. Some were peaceful. But I just think that it would just seem to me, Len, that without the Holy Spirit, without God and the Ten Commandments, that there's got to be some difference in the way you view violence, and you might feel more permission to act out on it if you don't have some guardrail. But anyway,
I agree with you 100% there, Sandy.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, sin is the root of all of this. And, I think back to the Assyrians and the Bible, you know, they were terrible people. And, you know, without God, without a sense of who God is and a willingness to submit to what he asks us to do, to love one another, to encourage one another, to forgive one another, without confessing that and getting right and humbling ourselves before God, then sin is going to take over, and sin will always get worse, never better.
Absolutely. Okay, so that brings me to this. We discussed this briefly on the phone, but I want to ask you now publicly here. Your folks, did they go to Rhodesia in like the 30s or the 40s?
1946.
Okay. So Christian missionaries have been working there hard, just like your brothers and sisters and you and other missionaries who've come, and that's particularly in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. What do you see as the fruit of your labors? Do you see fruit from your labors?
You know, Sandy, I'm glad you asked that question. Judy and I were just talking about this the other day, and my youngest brother just left there, and so this is the first year in the last, I don't know how many, well, since 1946, that we haven't had a family member serving in some way with the church in that country. But I said to Judy, I said, you know, it's bittersweet. When we go back now, there won't be any family there. So that's the bitter part of it. We still have lots of friends, though. And I said, but the sweet part is, when missionaries go to a land, they go with the good news of the gospel of peace, of love, of mercy, of grace, of forgiveness, and getting right with God and a new life in Christ and all of that, and establishing the local church. When Mom and Dad went, there was very little of that down in the Zambezi Valley. But today, the national church, the Evangelical Church of Zimbabwe, is thriving. It's grown. It's got its own leadership. It's just doing its own discipling. They're reaching out into Mozambique and other countries. They're doing an amazing job. So, yes, it's hard to see all the people that we knew and loved that served there that won't be there anymore. But our new friends in Christ, our brothers and sisters in Christ, are still there. And the church is blossoming and growing and taking responsibility for the good news of the gospel in that land. And I just praise God for that.
So do I. So do I, Lynn. So do I. It makes me, It thrills me because of my love for you guys and for the people. But all right, so moving south from there, I don't have to remind you that you served under Dick Winchell, who was a missionary in South Africa. He and his wife Marge, their family was part of our church. Their kids became missionaries too. They poured their heart and soul into South Africa. So can the same be said of South Africa now? What do you know, have any idea? I know that's not the country you're primarily involved with, but do you have any idea what the strength of Christian ministry is there?
You know, Sandy, I can't speak to that very much right now. I haven't really been staying in touch with that too closely, but absolutely, the church is growing. The church is, I believe, thriving in South Africa as well. It looks a little different in places. It sounds a little different. You know, the Dutch Reformed Church, which was the apartheid Dutch church, they're still going. They're struggling. They're having to adjust. But they have a real heart for the Lord. They want to continue serving the Lord. They support missionaries who go to India and places like that. God bless them for that. But there are also evangelical churches that are thriving, and there's Bible schools there. There's a lot going on. And then there's even seminaries that are in the cities for both black and white. Yes, I think the gospel is established in South Africa, and I don't think that'll ever leave. I know that communism has tried to take over. I know Islam is moving down through the trucking routes and that into South Africa and trying to have more and more influence. But the gospel is there, and the Lord has his people sharing the good news, and I'm just so thankful for that.
You know, Lynn, I don't know if you, I'm sure I haven't told you this, but Jeremy actually went to South Africa for a bit of a study trip to one of the, I wish I'd remembered to ask him before this, but I believe he was in Cape Town, and he was, and there is a, like a Christian university there. And he went to lecture.
Yes.
I believe he went to lecture on C.S. Lewis, which is, I'd forgotten about that. But that just kind of confirms what you just said. And I think it's kind of a cool wraparound. I want to close with this. I just would love your take on this. The chief rabbi of South Africa is a Goldstein. I don't know his first name. Rabbi Goldstein. And he taped a video in response to what happened in the Oval Office that was just amazing to me. And I just want to play just a little bit of it for you and get your response to it. And that's how we'll end today. He said, first of all, well, I'll play this one. Clip 16, let's listen to Rabbi Goldstein's take on what happened in the Oval Office. Let's listen.
As I watched the White House spectacle unfold, as I watched President Ramaphosa literally squirm in his seat, visibly uncomfortable, humiliated as President Trump accused him of genocide in his own country, I couldn't help but think, I'm not a prophet, and I do not presume to know the will of God. And yet, the thought kept crossing my mind. This moment, this humiliation, felt biblical. It felt like divine retribution. It felt like justice for a different, earlier sin. Because Ramaphosa and the ANC stood on a different global stage and falsely accused the Jewish state, the state of Israel, of genocide, a lie, a libel, a defamation of an entire nation. And now, in front of the whole world, they themselves are being accused of genocide. This time, a true genocide, demonstrated by the cold, brutal facts of a murder rate spiraling out of control. The blood of countless victims on their hands, and their total inability to protect South Africans of any race or background. It felt like what our sages call mida keneged mida, measure for measure, a precise justice, a reckoning. And as that thought took hold, another verse came to mind. I kept hearing the words of Genesis 12:3. Those who bless you will be blessed, and those who curse you will be cursed. President Ramaphosa and the ANC cursed Israel, and now it feels as though they are being cursed. You can feel it in the air, in the sense of decay and despair. You can feel the weight of a divine curse settling on this presidency.
All right, Lynn, that's heavy stuff. I just would, I'm throwing that at you without preparation, but what do you think about what he said?
Yeah. Well, I think that was well said. The wages of sin is death. And I believe that a light was shown on what's going on in South Africa, and that a lot of times the bad things that happen often are the result of sinful mankind and the choices he makes, the things he says, the things he does, and they need to get back to honoring God and doing it God's way, because the wages of sin is going to be real problematic for South Africa, and they need to understand and look to the Lord and seek repentance and trust God for a new heart to be able to manage, look to him for wisdom and knowing how to treat people and how to move forward as a nation. But I think it's right. And I've been very concerned too, you know, with all the economic letdown and everything else, but the way South Africa just seems to be going after China and Russia and support, and kind of because we've taken a bit of a stand against them, you know, things, it's just been uncomfortable all the way around. But I think this light that was shown on the situation, it may only be one of many issues in South Africa, but what it's going to do, like salt and light, it's going to start permeating, and it's going to get people talking. It's going to get people praying. It's going to get people maybe thinking about things differently that they wouldn't even have discussed before. And so I'm very thankful that it took place.
Okay, Lynn, I think that's a great ending. And we'll just see what God does, right? We will see what God does.
Yeah.
All right, Lynn Everswick, former regional director for Team Missions, the Evangelical Alliance Mission. Also, I didn't say He established an entire nearly missions agency at Westover Church in Greensboro, North Carolina. For many years, he started that and left it with missionaries all over the world, just that one church. It's amazing. So, Len, thanks for your hard work and your mark in this world for the gospel and for the richness you brought to my life. So thank you, Len Everswick, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Sandy, and God bless.
Thank you. Same to you. All right, Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7. Hi, this is Sandy Rios. A lot of Christians would be shocked to learn they are personally profiting from abortion and pornography. It's unnerving to realize just how many companies and corporations are actively involved in unbiblical practices. To help cut through the red tape, there is a great option known as Timothy Plan. Timothy Plan is the pioneer in biblically responsible investing. Timothy Plan carefully filters out companies involved in practices Scripture tells us to avoid. We are in an all-out culture war. One powerful way to make a difference is to put our money where our values are. Please go to timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy. Or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-846-7526. Discover how to be a biblically responsible investor.
Before investing, carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the investment company. This and other important information can be found in the fund's prospectus. To obtain a copy, visit timothyplan.com or call 800-846-7526. Read each prospectus carefully before investing.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
When you become a monthly sponsor of Preborn, you will actually get a picture of the babies you help to save. That's pretty good plum, isn't it? But also, you can sponsor what's called a day of life. And that's sponsoring an entire day of women, you know, having ultrasounds at these clinics. And it's more money. It's a bigger investment. For a gift of $5,000, you can sponsor an entire day. And so that's why we call it a day of life. If you'd like to do that, if you can afford to do that, go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy.
The Sandy Rios 24/7 podcast are available at AFR.net. Back to Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I'm saying to you, we've not called for the killing of white people, at least for now. I can't guarantee the future.
Yeah, but I mean, you'd understand somebody watching that, especially as it gets shared on Twitter, they freak out. It sounds like a genocidal call.
Cry babies.
Oh, okay. That's Julius Malemo, Member of Parliament, who you heard repeatedly saying, kill the Boer, kill the Boer, kill the farmer. And then he has on an interview, no, we're not calling for the killing of white farmers. And then at the end of that, he says, what does he say, crybabies? Don't you think people, this guy interviewing him, might be concerned about what they've heard you say? Oh, crybabies, that was his response. So this is what South Africa is dealing with. I think we painted a pretty good picture. I actually have a lot more interesting sidebars that I'm going to do a part two with you, just as an addition or an agenda to my conversation with Len. And we'll do that on the next show. I promise that. But I do appreciate you listening. And I want to thank Timothy Glenn for making it possible, because they show us all how to put our money where our values are and discover how to be a biblically responsible investor. Visit timothyplan.com/Sandy. That's timothyplan.com/Sandy. Or call 1-800-TIM-PLAN. That's 1-800-TIM-PLAN. Well, thank you for listening to today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.